This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. We began our show over the summer, and as we wrap up 2018, we figured it would be a good time to listen back to some of what we've produced. We'll go into the field with a longtime farmer. We'll also hear a possible solution to the state's teacher shortage, although there is a catch. We'll learn about a deadly plane crash in the early 80s that also put an end to an Illinois-based commuter air service.
And I tried to put myself in the place of one of those passengers. It's dark, the lights aren't working. Wouldn't you be a little concerned?
Also ahead, if you think you know what part of Illinois gets the best return on investment when it comes to tax dollars, you might be surprised. All of that ahead this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. Later, we'll take you along as we get a firsthand view of infrastructure needs, and we'll talk state budgeting. What does Illinois get right? What can it do better? All that and more this hour. Well, this fall marked 35 years since Air Illinois Flight 710 crashed. The commuter service flew to many smaller airports and provided a quick way for travelers to venture across the state. That was until October 11, 1983. The plane took off from Springfield, quickly ran into trouble, and a half hour later went down in a southern Illinois farm field near Pinckneyville, killing all 10 aboard. Bruce Rushton is a staff writer for the Illinois Times. He talked with us about the crash in an article titled Flying Blind. So, Bruce, this was a different time for air travel in Illinois. Air Illinois was among these commuter air services serving a lot of different smaller communities.
Oh, yeah. There was air service, regular air service to communities as small as Mount Vernon. There was regular air service between Decatur and Springfield, $5 each way in case you didn't want to drive. There were airlines as, running regular flights as small as Beechcrafts, which are very small civil airplanes with room for just five people in them. And these weren't, they were a combination somewhat of air taxis. That's what some folks would consider them to be. But this was considered to be a burgeoning industry in central and southern throughout Illinois. And there were predictions in 1974. There was a study done for the Capital Airport that predicted by 2005, looking forward into the future, if we extrapolate the increases in passenger traffic that we've seen in recent years, it arrives at 1.6 million people going through that airport per year in 2005. We've gotten nowhere close to that. I think last year there was something south of 200,000 that went through the airport in Springfield. But there were high expectations. The Daily Newspaper had a regular aviation column. It was published every Sunday right next to Ann Landers that was devoted exclusively to aviation in Springfield. It's a different time for newspapers and different time for aviation.
Well, let's go back to this crash, Flight 710, Air Illinois. Set the scene for us. This flight took off from Springfield. It's the fateful flight here that evening, and immediately, or pretty quickly, there was a problem detected.
Yeah, what happened was the flight it originated in Meigs Field in Chicago. It made the flight from Chicago to here in Springfield. I can't remember how many passengers disembarked in Springfield. There were seven aboard when the plane took off from Springfield. It was approximately 40, 45 minutes late. It was 20 minutes after 8 p.m. or so, mid-October. The weather was good here. It was deteriorating further south. There were some thunderstorms reported in the area. But that the weather wasn't really the issue. The issue was twofold. One, you had a mechanical issue. This plane had been having difficulty with its generator system, primarily the right generator. And the way you have to think about this is this aircraft was a 44-seater, has two generators that power the entire electrical system of the airplane. Everything from the instruments in the cockpits to the lights in the bathroom to the navigation lights outside. And the plane could fly and well, apparently, if just on just one generator. If both generators went out, then you were down to battery power. And the batteries in the plane were designed and could last for a minimum of 30 minutes. they had 30 minutes where they could have stayed aloft. After that, the electricity would have gone out. They would have had no instruments. They would have been in some fairly severe problems, particularly if they needed instruments to fly. The plane experienced a generator malfunction almost immediately upon takeoff from Springfield. And the first officer, i.e. the co-pilot of the plane, figured, oh, it's the right generator again. And so the first thing you're supposed to do if you have a generator issue in this aircraft is that you're supposed to isolate the faulty generator from the rest of the electrical system. So he isolated the right generator from the electrical system. The right generator was fine. The left generator was broken. And so, boom, he has no power from the generators. And so he quickly realizes, you know, what the issue is and tries to reconnect the right generator. Can't do it. Even though it's functioning, it's essentially of no help whatsoever because it's not providing any power to the plane. Within 5 minutes of the Springfield Airport, when they realize we don't have any generator power. And the pilot, Lester Smith, said, well, let's keep going south. And it's my understanding they passed, I thought I saw one reference, they passed something like 9 airports on this last journey before they finally came down in a pasture.
And they were headed toward Carbondale?
They were going to Carbondale. It was a 40-minute flight from, a scheduled 40-minute flight from Springfield to Carbondale. So they have a minimum of 30 minutes on battery power. They know that it's going to take 40 minutes. They might make it. The batteries might last. Batteries might not last. The co-pilot is, as you could imagine, is keeping a close eye on the voltage levels in the batteries. He wants to make sure that they've got enough juice. And they're flying along, and they look to be okay. You know, they're at 20-plus amps, and that's an electrical term, but it means that there's voltage. And 20-plus amps is considered to be, you're doing okay. What he didn't know, these were nickel-cadmium batteries as opposed to lead-based batteries. And nickel-cadmium batteries, they'll look fine until they're almost out of juice. And once they start showing any signs of depletion, they're going to go from 20 amps to zero very, very, very quickly.
This plane crashed in a farm field in Perry County, Pinckneyville.
Just outside Pinckneyville, yes.
And no one survived.
Nobody survived.
Eventually, pilot error was the determining factor. And basically, what the FAA said was the pilot should have turned back and gone to Springfield and landed when he noticed the problem.
Absolutely, he should have turned around. And it didn't really take an Einstein to figure that out. If you know that anything past 30 minutes on a battery is premium time, you're on borrowed time, and you're 40 minutes away from your destination, why he didn't turn around? Very, very good question. After the tragedy, as part of the investigation, the FAA interviewed, as a matter of course, fellow pilots and those who were familiar with Mr. Smith and his habits. He had a propensity to cut corners and to take chances to stay on schedule. And he was 40 minutes behind schedule this night. Plus, he lived in Carbondale. The assumption, the conclusion of investigators was he had a known history of trying to do things to stay on schedule, including he would fly under thunderstorms or very close to them rather than giving them wide berth. The wise course of manner is there's bad weather there. I'm going to take a little bit longer to get to my destination to avoid this thunderstorms. He'd go right up to the edge of them. When he was landing at Meigs Field and other places, he would exceed the maximum allowable speed for the aircraft. His shortfalls were well known within the staff of Air Illinois. In fact, one pilot told the FAA the National Transportation Safety Board investigators after the fact that she had asked the co-pilot, how can you just sit there and let him do these things? And he answered, well, I always keep a close eye on things, and I never let him get into a situation that I don't think we can recover from. Which is another mystery. All of my reporting, or a great deal of it, was based on the cockpit voice recorder. There was never at any point where the co-pilot said, Mr. Smith, we need to turn around, and we need to turn around now. On the ground controller, shortly after takeoff, the pilot said, I have an unusual request. We'd like to go down to 2,000 feet. Well, this plane is supposed to normally fly at 10,000 feet. And he'd also said, we have a slight electrical problem. Well, they didn't have a slight electrical problem. They had a major electrical problem. And so the controller said, I can't take you down to 2,000 feet because at that point you disappear from radar. So I'll let you go to 3,000 feet. That's what happened. At one point in time, a flight attendant came forward from the cabin and asked about, why is it dark back there? People are asking questions. And the pilot said, Mr. Smith said, well, we have an electrical problem, but we're going to continue to Carbondale and we have to conserve electricity. And I tried to put myself in the place of one of those passengers. It's dark. The lights aren't working. Wouldn't you be a little concerned? Man, I mean, the flight lasted, I think, didn't last 35 minutes. I think it lasted about 32. They came down 40 miles north of Carbondale, and they were headed northeast when they hit the ground, or excuse me, northwest when they hit the ground. So they were going in the wrong direction and fairly well short of their destination when they ran out of power.
We're talking with Bruce Rushton. He's a staff writer for the Illinois Times. He wrote about Flight 710 Air Illinois. This crashed back in the early 80s in southern Illinois. And Bruce, a lot more came out about Air Illinois, it seemed to, after this crash occurred. There were some shady things going on in the whole operation. Mm-hmm. The crash also served as a national wake-up call, I think, for this type of air travel, these cheaper airlines, smaller airlines, mm-hmm. and some of the things that were going on there. Talk about that as well.
It was somewhat a question of timing, let's put it that way. Remember, this is in October 1983. This is right after PATCO, the air traffic controllers, had gone on strike. It was an illegal strike, and Reagan had fired all the air traffic controllers. So Reagan was getting quite a bit of credit for it, not the least of which there were predictions at the time by folks, including the air traffic controllers, were absolutely vital to the air transportation system. If we go off the job, planes are going to be crashing and people are going to die. That didn't happen with regard to the air traffic controllers. But with a lot less attention, what Reagan had also done is dramatically reduce the number of inspectors assigned to watch over all the airlines in the United States, not just the small ones. And it was something, I believe, like a 7% cut. And so when Air Illinois went down, Reagan, of course, as all politicians do, have his political enemies. And you had Paul Simon, who was then U.S. representative, soon to be elected to the Senate, was helping lead the charge, saying, this is what happens when you reduce the number of regulators. Elizabeth Dole, shortly after this crash, announced on Meet the Press, she announced that they were going to increase the number of FAA inspectors back to 1981 levels. And within a number of months, they hired, I believe, 166 inspectors to watch over all the airlines. And they needed to, because in this particular case, one of the inspectors that was in charge with making sure the avionics, which are the electrical instruments on an airplane, he was supposed to be inspecting those. Well, he'd had knee surgery. So he hadn't made it down to Air Illinois in a while, but no issues. Another person was supposed to have done that. And that person said, I don't know anything about avionics. I'm not qualified to do this. The way that it was termed in the crash report was that the inspections were, quote, less aggressive than they should have been. It turned out mechanics were falsifying records. Parts are supposed to be inspected on a regular basis. But it was easier to inspect the parts sooner, some of these parts, sooner than they were supposed to be inspected while they had everything apart. So they'd do it then and then post-date the records to make it look like the parts had been inspected on a regular basis as they were supposed to have been done. There were records that were hidden from the FAA. It was crystal clear in the report. The investigators did, I think, probably the obvious thing. They blamed the pilot. It was pilot error. He should have turned around. But they also said there are these other issues that need to be addressed. And they were addressed in some form or fashion, at least by the hiring of more inspectors.
So that was somewhat the legacy of the Air Illinois Flight 710. But also it seems to me that some of the legacy was the decline of this type of air travel. It seemed as though maybe people, like you said, I can, instead of driving or trying to get there in some other way, I can take a quick flight pretty cheap to get someplace. People might have thought twice about that.
They may have thought twice about it. I mean, I know I kind of think a little bit when I get in a plane when I can't stand upright. That's kind of a little, and that's still in the back of, I think, of people's minds. Am I on Wright Brothers Airlines here or what is it? But I think it's more than that. It came out after the crash, that Air Illinois had never been profitable. I mean, it had been flying for 14 years. They had some financial issues. It wasn't a particularly healthy business. And after the crash, they were going to be bought out by, I believe, Midwest Airlines. The airline quit flying for a month. It resumed on a limited basis. There was talk of it being bought out. Midwest Airlines was one of the larger airlines then in existence outside of the Deltas and the Uniteds of the world, and they backed out of it. And I'm not sure that it was because people were just afraid to fly. It's just the economics of it. You can't fly from Mount Vernon to Decatur to Timbuktu with four people on a 50, or 20-seat plane and make money at it. It just doesn't seem like it's possible. There had been a prior crash in 1971 that didn't get the same amount of attention, but it certainly helped Air Illinois establish itself as one of the dominant smaller airlines in the state. And that was a crash that happened at the Peoria Airport, Chicago and Southern. The gentleman who was flying the plane was also the president of the airline, and if that's not potentially problematic, and it was noted as potentially problematic after the fact, he was trying to land in dense fog. There had been two planes, Ozark Airlines, that had made a combined five approaches and aborted each one, then landed elsewhere. Couldn't see where he was going, dense fog. And he tried it anyway, ended up in power lines. The plane turned into a fireball. All 16 aboard crashed. And it turned out after the fact the airline was so strapped that it couldn't buy fuel in Chicago or Springfield. They wouldn't sell it to him on credit. He'd been cited numerous times by regulators for such things as flying with instruments despite not having passed a proficiency check. Pilots had routinely apparently exceeded the amount of time they were supposed to be on duty. They were popping no-dos and diet pills to stay awake. And so this is not the sort of industry that we know and expect today. At least I certainly hope that if I go into a cockpit today, we're not seeing and hearing these sorts of conversations. And so people are afraid to get into smaller airplanes, but it's also a question of economics. And I think a lot of the planes of these smaller commuter airlines, the smaller airlines still, of course, exist, but oftentimes they're feeders to the larger ones. They have contracts with the Americans of the world, for lack, just to pull a name out of the air, so that they will bring folks from smaller communities such as Springfield into the airports where they can make connections in St. Louis or Chicago or where have you. But back then, there was just an expectation that, airplanes are a wave of the future, when why drive when you can fly?
That's Bruce Rushton with the Illinois Times. He wrote about the crash of Air Illinois Flight 710. We talked with him earlier this year, and you can find a link to his story available at our website at statewideshow.com. Up next, paying Illinois taxes. Who benefits, Chicago or other parts of the state? That answer is on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, we'll find out about a potential solution to the state's teacher shortage. But next, it is a staple of downstate political campaigns. State government is taking our tax money and sending it off to Chicago. The truth, however, is just the opposite, and it's one of the ways in which political scientist John Jackson has demonstrated that the beliefs of Illinois voters are often at odds with the facts of state spending. Our State House reporter Brian Mackey has more in this report.
This story begins on Metra's BNSF Railway, which stretches from downtown Chicago to Aurora in the far western suburbs.
A night of commuter chaos for thousands of Metra riders. Train problems caused major delays for the second Monday night in a row.
Some of these lines, particularly the BNSF, have had so many significant problems throughout the summer.
Metra says this time signal failures caused delays. The problems started during the evening rush, and that caused passengers to become upset here at Union Station.
In a general statement on its website, Metra says it's facing the worst financial crisis in its 33-year history, and it blames its deteriorating infrastructure in part on cuts in state spending. If you do manage to get a BNSF train out of Chicago, one of the stops you can make is in the town of Western Springs. The station happens to be just inside the legislative district of Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin, who earlier that very Monday was part of an anti-tax news conference organized by Governor Bruce Rauner's re-election campaign. In it, Durkin had tough words for what he called
more Democrat spending, which is the root evil and the root problem of all issues that we have in Springfield.
While Metra and other government entities are crying out for more money, Republicans and some Democratic legislators are saying no. this disconnect, this divide over how the government responds to competing and growing demands for money is the fight that's dominated state politics for most of this century. Who should pay for government? How and where should that money be spent?
Are we getting our fair share out of state government? Do we get our cut of the pie? Everybody asks that of themselves, particularly if they're concerned about or up in arms about their tax bill.
John Jackson is a professor of political science at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale.
It's probably a more explosive question in Illinois because we have such a long-standing, divisive debate about regionalism, and that debate takes the form of Chicago, Cook County, versus downstate. And downstate, that resonates because we firmly believe that we're not getting our fair share.
Jackson has spent years documenting what Illinoisans think they know about their state government. His latest research paper, written with John Foster, is called The Politics of Public Budgeting in Illinois. We often hear politicians, particularly when they're campaigning downstate, talk about not sending our tax dollars to Chicago and Chicago sucking up all the tax money in the state. What is the reality?
Well, the reality is just the opposite. Downstate does very well, actually. If you define fair share as getting a dollar back for every dollar sent to Springfield, the only two negative numbers are for Cook County and the five suburban counties, the collar counties. The collar counties actually get 53 cents back for every dollar they pay in. Cook County doesn't break even, but they get 90 cents back, whereas downstate does quite all right. Central Illinois gets $1.87 back. And we in Southern Illinois do the best at $2.81 back for every dollar sent to Springfield. And that just debunks the legend that is out there, but a deeply ingrained part of our political culture.
Indeed. Jackson says without public universities, community colleges, and prisons, and the spending those institutions and their employees do in their communities, in Southern Illinois, there would be very little economic activity at all without the state. And in polling the Simon Institute has done, people seem to recognize the value of that state spending. During the budget impasse, one poll listed specific areas of state government spending and asked whether it should be cut. The people who responded overwhelmingly rejected cuts to schools, state universities, public safety, anti-poverty programs, and support for people with disabilities. Of course, almost all of them also thought cuts should be at least part of the solution to Illinois' financial problems.
Well, we've had that finding consistently over 10 straight years of Paul Simon public polls, and that finding shows the incongruity of always wanting supposedly to cut programs and to, quote, cut waste and fraud. But waste and fraud is always someone else's program. When you look at it, political scientists call that disconnect as symbolic conservatives and operational liberals. And that's the way the legislature has essentially acted and government in the state has acted. They wind up borrowing money and not paying the bills as a result of doing exactly what their constituents want.
That idea of symbolic conservatives and operational liberals reminds me of something a state senator told me years ago. It was Jeff Schoenberg, a Democrat from Evanston, who since left the legislature. The governor at the time, Pat Quinn, had proposed closing a few state facilities, and downstate legislators were resisting.
They talk a good game about being fiscally conservative, but when it comes to closing a public facility that's underutilized or not cost efficient, they're like New Deal Democrats.
Well, the phrase is often they always want to show up at the ribbon cutting. Let me quickly add, this is also true of the United States as a whole. The Congress as a whole is doing what the people want. That is, they are giving us the programs, but not making this generation pay for them. They're putting the payment off.
You mentioned that you've seen these sorts of incongruities in the electorate, maybe misunderstandings over a decade now. What does this mean for the enterprise of the people governing themselves in Illinois, for mass democracy?
Well, mass democracy has to depend ultimately on people being informed, and it'd be great if much of the debate were at least influenced by the facts. And so one of the reasons we did this study was to make sure that this argument is fact-driven, which it currently is definitely not. The whole question of what is reality is up for debate and up for grabs in the national scene. And I think that's a pernicious question for the future of mass democracy, which after all depends on an informed electorate.
All right. Well, on that optimistic note, John Jackson, thank you for speaking with me today.
Okay, Brian, good to talk with you.
John Jackson is with the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, where he's also an emeritus professor of political science. I'm Brian Mackey.
It's clear Illinois government has some deep fiscal problems. A backlog of unpaid bills, pension debt, a growing list of infrastructure needs. The problems can be overwhelming, but there are some best practices that can be taken to improve the situation. Professor Beverly Bunch is with the University of Illinois Springfield. She's also worked with the nonpartisan Volcker Alliance and studied what other states are doing, right and wrong. We talked with her before she spoke at a conference earlier this year, which was held by the Alliance and the Federal Reserve Bank. You say transparency is the key. The term transparency, what are we talking about here?
Transparency means making it clear to both the policymakers, including state elected officials and bureaucrats, as well as the general public and other stakeholders, what it is the state's doing. And one of the key things is looking at the intergenerational impact. If they're making decisions today that are the phrase kicking the can down the road and imposing additional burdens on future generations, we need to know that. And that's an important part of transparency.
You mentioned also long-term forecasting. When we talk long-term, it seems as though I often hear lawmakers only talking about the budget year that's ahead of them. Are they really looking that far down the road?
It does seem like elected officials in particular focus on the next year because that's what their constituents are most concerned about. Here in Illinois, we do multi-year revenue and expenditure forecasting, both the Governor's Office of Management Budget and the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability do it. And typically, we look at anywhere, for example, for 3 years into the future. Going farther is a little harder, but we don't want to just look at the next year. We want to see what's coming.
So those are good things that Illinois is doing. What are some things Illinois is not doing that it should be?
Well, probably the biggest one is Illinois is not paying its bills. And I think we've seen the growth of the unpaid vendor bills and then the pension liabilities and then something else called other post-employment benefits, which is putting aside for retirees' health insurance. And then the state also should be doing what many other states are doing is having a rainy day fund, some kind of putting money aside in case it rains, i.e. an economic recession. And it's not a matter of if that'll occur. It's more a matter of when and how deep.
That does have a rainy day fund, though, correct, in the budget?
They call it the Budget Stabilization Fund, and even at the height of its funding, it was only $276 million, which is less than 0.1% of the state budget. And then it got spent down during the budget impasse, and now there's just a very minimal balance. So, no, I would say on paper we have it, but it's not funded.
I would guess there are people listening who might say, you know, I know Illinois' budget is a mess, and I bet it's the worst in the country, and Illinois is not doing anything about it. But you're looking at what a lot of states have done in best practices. Is Illinois overall, you know, trying to dig itself out in some way? Is it doing at least enough to get itself on that path forward, or are we really as bad as many people think?
Well, clearly the increase in the income tax rate was addressing a big part of the problem. Unfortunately, it's not sufficient. There are still a big gap in the budget, and then there also are these unpaid liabilities. So it was a step in the right direction. I don't like taxes any more than anybody else does, but I also don't like pushing the fiscal burden onto our children and grandchildren. That's not fair. These are the services we're consuming today, and we should be paying for them today.
And that seems to be really at the root of some of the problems, isn't it? That the state of Illinois, I don't want to say people aren't being truthful about how the budget is put together and the revenues and expenditures and such, but at the same time, this important conversation is not being held with the voters, with the public and the taxpayers about what needs to be done. That's not getting through.
I think that's true, Sean. And I think the analogy I like to use is, what if I just started supporting myself on my credit card and say, oh, I'm not going to worry about it. My kid's got a good job and they'll pay it off later. And that's not fair. We wouldn't do that to our children in a personal point of view, and we shouldn't be doing that to future generations from a public point of view.
We're talking with Professor Beverly Bunch of the University of Illinois Springfield. The term deferred maintenance is going to be the title of the panel that you're on. A lot of people hear that term. They think of things like infrastructure, repairs that get pushed off because there's not enough money to do it. That seems to be something that occurs when government doesn't plan for the future.
That's true. And also when we get into fiscal crisis, one of the first things that we choose not to fund is maintenance. And we'll say like, oh, we can do that later. But eventually it builds up and over time it gets worse. It's like a family. If they don't replace their roof and it rains hard, then they may end up with structural damage and it'll end up costing a lot more. And that's true of state facilities as well as transportation and other infrastructure.
And of course, there is a cost involved. Do other states deal with maintenance costs on a regular basis? Do they pass certain programs to deal with it? How do most of them do it?
Well, the truth of it is the Volcker Alliance has found that deferred maintenance is really not clearly reported. We don't have a very good feel for how big it is and how states are addressing it. There are a few states. California is dealing with it. The state of Texas is dealing with the facility portion. But as a whole, I'd say it's a weak link in trying to ensure fiscal sustainability.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Beverly, but but certainly we're in the midst of an election cycle. We're seeing a lot of advertising from candidates with a lot of wealth, so they're able to get messages out there. But really, are they talking in the terms about the budget that need to be discussed here going into an election season?
Unfortunately, I don't think they are. I think, sometimes people act like we have two budgets. One's the current budget, and it's close to being balanced, but it's not. And then they forget to talk about all these huge unpaid liabilities, including deferred maintenance, and as I said before, pensions and retiree health insurance and the unpaid vendor bills, and then the debt service on bonds that we've issued to partially address those other issues as well as capital.
Whoever is elected as the next governor, whether it's Governor Rauner another term or J.B. Pritzker, whoever wins this race, they're going to have to deal with some of these issues because the state probably cannot keep going down this path. It doesn't seem to me like it's going to be able to do that much longer.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, investors are going to say enough is enough. But, we shouldn't have to wait for Moody's or the bond rating companies or the investors to tell it's enough. This is our state, and we should say we're ready to stand up and pay for what burden we're otherwise going to leave our children.
We were talking about deferred maintenance, which oftentimes can fall into things like capital spending, which is, things like roads and buildings, bridges, things like that. The state has not had a program in place to really deal with that for quite some time. It often needs its own revenue source to pay off bonding that goes with it. Keep hearing that everybody wants one. Everybody's talking that one may occur in the next administration. Talk about that and how it's done nationally and then Illinois and the problems that Illinois has had getting one.
Illinois does do a best practice, which is the governor's budget office prepares a multi-year capital plan identifying what the needs are. But as you said, the funding of that plan is what's critical. And Illinois has a tendency to, every 10 years, do it in a big way, issue bonds and say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And it's been about 10 years since we last did it. So now's the time to start prioritizing and really get a good survey of what the needs are, to do an analysis. Right now, it's pretty decentralized. IDOT Transportation does their own, the higher ed does their own, the K-12 schools do their own. But we need to put it all in one place and get a big picture of what the critical needs are and then begin prioritizing and identifying funding.
That's Professor Beverly Bunch with the University of Illinois Springfield. She's also done extensive work with the nonpartisan Volcker Alliance. We spoke with her last summer. talk more on infrastructure needs in Illinois coming up. Stay with us on Statewide. This is Statewide. We've been producing the show since the summer. Today, you're listening back to some of what we brought you in 2018. Still to come, a story on a farmer who's been working the land for decades and the changes he's seen. But right now, Illinois roads and bridges are in disrepair. And even after a two-year budget impasse and a backlog of bills, infrastructure continues to take a back seat. There's been talk of a major construction program coming in 2019, but to make that happen, the magnitude of the problem has to be understood by lawmakers. Our Daisy Contreras took us along this year on an infrastructure tour.
It's an August morning in Athens, about 20 miles north of downtown Springfield, and I'm at a quarry run by Hanson Material Service. A so-called transportation tour is underway. Lawmakers are here to evaluate how different sectors in central Illinois are impacted by the state's decaying infrastructure. Large machines are working on the rock below us.
Well, what you're looking into is the pit where Hanson Material Service here is mining stone from the ground. It's in its geological formation right now. The process starts with stripping the soil on top of the rock.
That's Sean McKinney with the Illinois Association of Aggregate Producers, whose members provide the raw materials for road and bridge construction, and just about any project that needs rock, sand, or gravel to make concrete or asphalt. Trucks then transport the material to clients across the state.
The process of once the material is moved here from the muck pile into a haul truck and taken back to a processing plant, just later that day it's available for customers to purchase.
But without the money to invest on the hundreds of bridges and roads needing repair, some trucks are forced to lessen their loads or go around, slowing down the entire process. The state has not had a major construction program since 2009, so repairs are done more incrementally. Just a few miles away in Menard County, one bridge is getting minimal in-house repairs, just to keep it open. Many other bridges like this one are in the same condition, or worse.
It's not load posted.
Tom Casson is a highway engineer.
The structural deficiency on this bridge is the timber piles rotten away, and it's not adequate to support the loads. So if we don't repair it and keep tending to it, IDOT's going to close it. And then when they close it, I don't have the money to replace it and reopen it. So all I can do is keep repairing.
Casson says while the county receives some state money for repairs, the amount hasn't changed in about 40 years. And the costs for materials and labor have since gone up.
So it's kind of hard to keep up with the program when there's not enough money out there.
Earlier this year, a report spearheaded by the American Society of Civil Engineers gave Illinois a C-minus for the overall quality of its infrastructure. Groups like the Transportation for Illinois Coalition, who planned the tour for legislators, say if no significant investment is made in the state's transportation funding, almost 40% of roads and 20% of bridges will be in unacceptable condition in less than 4 years. The group is made up of labor, business, and transportation advocates, who came together to rally behind a long-term sustainable funding plan. One solution lawmakers and groups are exploring is raising the motor fuel tax, which is paid at the gas pump. The tax of 19 cents per gallon hasn't changed in nearly three decades. Meanwhile, the state is being squeezed by more fuel-efficient vehicles that still cause wear and tear on roads but fill up less often. Bordering states like Indiana, Michigan, and Iowa have raised their gas taxes in the last few years. Some suggest Illinois may need to increase the tax by another 10 or even 15 cents per gallon to meet the state's needs. Other ideas include a per-mile tax charge based on how much someone drives. State Representative Marcus Evans, a Chicago Democrat who chairs the state's transportation committee, says he sees it as a possibility, but says he'd like to make sure taxpayers give feedback on what matters to them first.
You know, we're not looking to, again, tap folks for another tax. We're looking to prioritize how we get to that point. But before you get there, you have to come to a conclusion that we must do something to address our roads because the problem is going to cost us more later.
The lack of funding is also costing Illinois drivers. An estimate places the annual figure at about $600 each for extra vehicle repairs and operating costs, just for driving on roads in need of repair. State Representative Margo McDermott of Mokena, the leading Republican on that committee, says it's also important for other lawmakers, regardless of location, to see the benefits of having a transportation plan.
And make sure they understand that that applies to the whole state, that this helps everyone. All 118 rep districts will experience an improvement if we have a transportation capital plan.
Both Evans and McDermott aren't from the central Illinois area, but the transportation tour, they say, has given them a chance to see firsthand the needs they've only heard about.
And what we got to do today was to experience what good condition is like, what poor condition is like, and to see it and to feel it.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
Like most states, Illinois is struggling with a severe teacher shortage. Also like most states, that shortage is felt most profoundly in the area of special education. There is, however, an army of teacher assistants already on the job. Could they help relieve the shortage? Our Dusty Rhodes prepared this report.
Decades ago, when these assistants were known as teacher's aides, they did a lot of Xeroxing worksheets and could be hired with a high school diploma. Nowadays, they need 60 hours of college credit or a certain score on a certification test. Most administrators refer to them as paraprofessionals, and their duties are more complex than clearing jams from the copy machine. Terry Kays has been a parapro since 2004. She works for the Kaskaskia Special Education District in southern Illinois.
A paraprofessional is like a teacher's aide, but we work with children that have special needs and behavior disorders.
Can you give me an example?
A lot of ADHD, oppositional defiance disorders, the explosive disorders. We've seen a lot of that. I am currently working in a high school room with autism.
It sounds like paraprofessionals kind of handle the hardest kids.
Yes, absolutely. Believe me, we've been through some.
Yolanda Harrington works as a parapro in a Champaign elementary school.
I don't think they realize the wear and tear that our job has on us physically and mentally. I mean, there are kids that get aggressive with us. There are kids we have to pick up. There's diapering. There's feeding. There's kids running away from us. We do the whole gamut. I don't think they realize how much we actually really do and how much we really, really care about the kids.
Harrington and Kays and other parapros I talked to say kids are the best part of their job because in many districts, paraprofessionals have another unwritten duty. They're the workers school districts use to balance the budget. Paraprofessionals are paid on average about $14 an hour. Some districts limit those hours to avoid having to provide health insurance. And in some districts, parapros are routinely laid off in June, then rehired when school starts a few months later. After one such layoff in 2012, Kaskaskia Special Ed recalled parapros under a new contract that wiped out seniority and passed pay raises. Kays, who had been making about $26,000 a year, saw her salary cut in half.
All of the extras went out the window. Since 2012, there has been no internet service, been no TV service, none of that in my home.
How old is your car?
My car is a 1996. I just say, keep running, baby.
Bob Chicos, a special ed teacher in Crystal Lake, doesn't see paraprofessionals as expendable staff.
A paraprofessional is basically my eyes, ears, and arms in the classroom. There always has to be teacher present by state law, but a paraprofessional can do a lot of the duties just as a teacher.
Chicos has done extensive research on the teacher shortage, and he suggests that districts could use parapros like a farm team, cultivating the best ones to become teachers. But there's one major problem. Even if they could earn an advanced degree in their spare time, they'd still be required to serve one semester as a student teacher for free.
We're talking about people who didn't get paid a whole lot to begin with, and then expect them to take 4 months off from a job to student teach. Like, that's going to eliminate a lot of people from moving up.
Of course, not all parapros want to be teachers. Unlike teachers, parapros don't have to make lesson plans or take stacks of essays home to grade. But some, like Yolanda Harrington, have given it a shot.
I was actually going to school to be a teacher.
She got to the point of taking the 5-hour Pearson Test of Academic Proficiency, known as TAP, but says she fell a few points below the score required to advance to upper-level education courses.
And so since I had been going part-time for so long, I just got burnt out. So I ended up getting a degree in general studies. A bachelor's.
The State Board of Education has just released a 27-page report meant to address the teacher shortage. It includes several ideas for lowering licensure requirements, even eliminating that TAP test that discouraged Harrington. But none of the recommendations specifically address smoothing the path for paraprofessionals to become teachers. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
You can find out more on that story. Just go to our website at statewideshow.com. There have been a lot of changes in agriculture through the decades, from the equipment used to the amount of land needed to sustain a livelihood. Gary Oxley is an Illinois man who's been farming for more than seven decades. And during harvest season, our Jacqueline Driscoll visited with him.
It was a sunny day, warmer than usual for harvest, when I hopped in Gary Oxley's silver 98 model gleaner combine. The first thing I noticed were his hands, worn, aged by the sun, and his gold wedding band slipped down near his knuckle, unable to stay in the place where it used to sit as a young man.
Occasionally I get on the wrong road, isn't that?
Gary is 87 years old, and he still sows and harvests seeds on the family farm in Modesto, a small village about 40 miles southwest of Springfield. He started as a teenager, helping his dad and grandpa.
That's all I'd ever done, really. Just kind of what I wanted to do, so I just never had any idea of really doing anything else.
Gary has seen a lot of changes in this job over his seven decades spent in the fields. In fact, he says, not much is the same.
In 41, my dad traded all the horses and horse-drawn equipment off to an Alice dealer for a tractor.
Alice Chalmers was a U.S. manufacturer that gained fame for their bright orange tractors and silver combines. The company is long gone. Sitting in an air-conditioned combine, Gary told me about harvesting crops in machinery that didn't have a cab.
Especially if the wind was just right, and the Alice Chalmers combines, the pull type, had canvases on them. One run this way, and the other picked it up and took it in. And that top one would throw grain right to your back of your neck a lot of times. Quite different than it is now.
Of course, today, it's almost rare to see a combine that harvests less than eight rows at a time. Years ago, it might have taken weeks to harvest 100 acres. Today, that can be done in 8 hours. And a couple hundred acres with some livestock? That was a livelihood. But today, Gary says farming is starting to resemble a corporation. He's watched families sell off their ground because they just can't compete with the big guys.
I guess there's fewer farmers all the time anymore. It used to be a lot of them, though. You can see if you drive through the country where the houses have been and are gone now, you know.
In the past 5 years, farmers have suffered from declining market prices for grain. Gary, of course, remembers when they were much lower, but it was just a different time.
Last year, I believe corn was around $4 a bushel and beans 10. Now they've dropped quite a bit, but you look back in records years back, why corn might have been $1.50 or so, beans $2 and something, but our input prices were much lower too, so that makes a difference.
He watched his father and grandfather build the farm from the ground up, gaining valuable life lessons along the way. He also credits the matriarch of the family, his wife of 61 years, Lila, who maintained a household while managing the books for the farm.
So you married your wife and you had a son and then you had a daughter, right? And your wife stayed home and you farmed. Kind of sounds like the Midwestern dream.
Well, I've done pretty well, yeah.
Now he gets to see his son Doug and grandson Brandon take over.
Are you proud that you went into farming?
Yes, I am. I didn't go to college anymore. You don't get a job anywhere unless you went to college. I just like this type of life. Living in the country.
Does it make you proud to see Doug and Brandon?
Yes, it do. Yeah, they're doing all right.
What do you hope for Doug and Brandon when you're gone?
Well, I hope they're able to continue, make a living at it.
I was still in high school when I put in my first wheat crop.
Gary's son Doug is happy to continue the legacy, giving his dad all the credit for his knowledge of farming.
Oh, just about everything takes a lot of hard work, and you got to bore down and get it done when it's time to, when hay's down, you got to make hay.
And Brandon, he says the same. He says his granddad taught him.
Value the hard day's work and what you can accomplish if you put your mind to it.
Maintaining the farm is and always will be a family affair, one the Oxleys are proud to be a part of. Around the noon hour, we said our goodbyes, and I watched the Oxley men slide into Doug's 1973 Chevy pickup. They headed off to lunch at Doug's childhood home, where ham, mashed potatoes, and a vegetable waited for them, cooked by Lila, of course. These days, most farmers will get something fried at the local pub and eat quickly in the tractor. But Gary insists on a break and a hot meal, maybe a little old school, but a staple on the Oxley family farm. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
That wraps up our final show of 2018. Thanks for being with us. Join us for Statewide in the new year. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And a reminder, you can find us at statewideshow.com, including all of our past episodes. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.